Highlighting Delmarva traditions. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The National Folk Festival, to be held in Salisbury later this year, will feature the culture and contributions of the region. Maryland Traditions Folklife Area and Stage will spotlight the distinctive music, rituals, crafts, occupations, food, and traditions of the state. These can range from the art of decoy carving and storytelling from Crisfield to classic Smith Island cake and the region's watermen with the iconic skipjack. Take a look at the latest lineup in our studio this morning is Laura Bottinelli, Executive Director of the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art, and I'm by phone, Julia Olem. She is the Executive Director for the National Council for Traditional Arts. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, I want to start with you and give us a sense about what kind of thinking is going on behind the idea of particularly focusing in on the traditions of Maryland and particularly the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, while the National Folk Festival is a national celebration of our performative traditions and cultural heritage, we think it's each festival is really distinctive and meant also to reflect the traditions of the host city, state, region, and it gives each festival a very unique quality. So what could be more perfect than for the first theme of the Folklife Festival in the first year in Salisbury than to focus on the fascinating deep traditions of the Chesapeake region?
So when you go to a region, obviously ours have particular characteristics. What kinds of things do you look for in terms of what you want to focus on when it comes to a particular region, whether it's Chesapeake Bay or other areas?
Well, we really work collaboratively with cultural specialists in the state and locale. We're very fortunate to have the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art as a major partner in this endeavor, but we put together a committee, actually a very large committee, of cultural specialists, and there's a lot of discussion about what's important to do, what is important to share with the public, and the decisions are made in that way.
Laura, when you, obviously, one of the big consultants, matter of fact, you're one of the biggest movers, actually, and shakers about getting this thing here, at least that's what the mayor says, but we won't discount that. So when you were looking at drawing up a list and looking at the kinds of things that you want to do, because you're involved, actually, you know, as being a head of the Ward Museum, you're obviously involved in more than just the decoys, but in the culture itself.
Well, so the museum has a lot of experience through our Lower Shore Traditions program working in the cultural communities of Delmarva. And that was part of the strength of when we were applying to bring the Nationals to Salisbury, was that in addition to our city being sort of a ripe urban downtown to revitalize through the power of the festival, is that we had this existing network of cultural research, cultural scholars, and tradition bearers who could help curate the showcase of local traditions. So when we went back into our network, we knew that there were some emerging themes. It was really the power of the marsh, the power of the water, and the power of agriculture for building and sustaining tradition in our area over many years. It has contributed heavily to our regional identity and also our regional industries. And through other programming that we've done at the Ward Museum and through the state partner Maryland Traditions, we were able to then define across the Chesapeake region who would be some of those master artists and tradition bearers to bring in. Now, since our network was very strong on the Lower Shore, you will see that a number of tradition bearers from Somerset County, Worcester County, Wicomico County, Dorchester County are featured. But we do reach all the way up and around the bay with the types of individuals that we're bringing together. You mentioned the things like Smith Island cake.
Right, we'll
and the
get
watermen
to that
traditions.
Yes, right.
Yeah, maybe we should just, I'll just segue right into that. So Smith Island cake is Maryland state dessert, but more importantly, it's really a signature element of the island that has really allowed people to discover Smith Island and have a way to access the rich culture there. You know, if I think most people listening to Delmarva today probably know what a Smith Island cake is. It's this layered cake. And Janice Marshall and Marietta Marshall of Smith Island will both be able to share those their background as women of Smith Island who have been able to utilize the cake as a way to share the history and culture of the island. The research, the cake was, you know, several decades ago was just basically found. What is this? It's cake. Well, no, this is something different. No, it's cake.
As a matter of fact, we have a clip actually of Mary Ada Marshall, and she's the third down, by the way, in our list. She's a lifelong resident of Smith Island, makes, by the way, Smith Island cakes, and has certainly mastered that distinctive tradition. Here's how she describes learning how to make this Smith Island cake.
One of the things that a woman would want to achieve before she married was to be able to make a layer cake. And it sort of became a challenge as to how many layers and how thin you could get them and who could bake the most layers on a cake. And I think it's where the multi little tiny layers came from. It became a challenge to us as to who could get the most layers. So all of a sudden we go to another social, and here's one with 8 layers. Here's one with 10 layers. And it just got to be a thing. I never really did pay much attention to the fact that they had a lot of little layers and that the layers were baked individually. It just becomes something we learned to do pretty much on our own. We didn't really think we had something special, but evidently we did.
By the way, Julia, have you had some Smith Island there?
Oh, are you kidding me? I am like a total fan. We have come out on trips and bought an entire cake that I was going to take to the office.
Right.
It did not make it out of our own personal home kitchen.
By the way, tell me, Laura, a little bit about Marietta Marshall. I mean, she's been there for a very long period of time, I guess. And by the way, we should mention, by the way, that the Smith Island cake is now, I believe, the official state dessert as well.
That's right.
2008.
It was through Marietta's efforts with others, including the Lower Eastern Shore Heritage Council, that they were ambassadors of this tradition of Smith Island in order to have it become the state dessert. And now Marietta is, you know, in addition to baking cakes, is very much a part of the cultural community of Smith Island. She's connected to all the waterman culture and the water women, and has served as this great voice for the island in order for people to understand what's special, especially as the pressures of the island have changed related to the economics and other conditions. So just as an aside, tomorrow, Saturday, is the Delmarvelous Festival at the Ward Museum, and Marietta Marshall will be one of our featured presenters there. So if anyone wants to come and meet Marietta ahead of the National Folk Festival, they can. But at the National, she will be presenting Smith Island cake in what is our food waste stage. So the Maryland Folklife area of the Nationals has a kitchen stage. And so she is one of the tradition bearers who will be sharing the story of the cake, showing you how it's made, and it's part of experience of getting close to culture. So you get to learn a little. If you don't know about Smith Island cake, this for the next 3 months, come again.
You will be able to. Well, I want to turn to some of the cakes, maybe just a little closer to your heart, which is, of course, decoy carving. Got a whole slew of those there at the museum there. Let's start with Rich Smoker. In fact, we interviewed him some time back for a series we did about. He's basically a master decoy carver. And he began his journey at an early age, apprenticed actually originally as a taxidermist. And this clip comes from the Delmarva Almanac.
I'll just begin the reduction process of that wood, either with a hatchet, with draw knife, spoke shaves, knives, finishing with power tools. Then the fun begins is the painting, which is what I really love to do, is sit and paint, paint on the birds. I can just get lost in that. And I think that's pretty much the long and the short of it. It's really a process of using your imagination, and if you can use your imagination, if you can visualize something in the wood, you can get it out of the wood.
So So, Laura, this is a great tradition, not only obviously on the Chesapeake Bay, but we're really famous nationally and internationally.
That's right. The connection between land and water has been such a part of Chesapeake experience that the hunting traditions and the object of the decoy, that when someone could have that and hold that and understand that this is, one, an art form, and it's a beautiful example of folk art. It carries the story of the way the land, the water, and the working communities and the need to eat are all connected.
Right.
Rich, as someone who is carving traditional working decoys, is able to share that story of how it relates to him, his carving art relates to him personally as an artist, but then also more deeply to the traditions of the Bay, and then also more broadly why this is important to people outside of our area. They're using decoys across the country and around the world, but the Chesapeake has become sort of an icon of the decoy tradition, very much because of the reputation of Lemon Steve Ward. The Ward Museum is named. But, you know, when you come to the museum and you see, and we try to connect the decoy to someone who doesn't know anything about it, what I like, especially with the older birds, is that the regional traditions are captured in wood because the decoys were carved to respond to the local environment. So a decoy carved in Chesapeake is different than a decoy carved for Newfoundland, right, or something like that. And the artists themselves were also keeping sort of traditional styles within their working communities. So there's an incredible way to capture the way folk arts are connected to place and connected to community. And that's what you see when you see a decoy, in addition to being part of the regional history of the need to eat.
The need to eat. And Julia, we mentioned a moment ago that, I mean, obviously decoy carving is not just here in the Chesapeake Bay, but there are other areas as well. What's your been experience as head of the folk festival?
Well, actually, you know, the festival's been all over the nation, but this is the first time that we have the festival has been in an area with such a deep tradition of decoy carving.
Okay, and
I would say that, sure, you know, for visitors coming to the festival, I think one of the most exciting things is going to be their discovery of local and regional traditions.
And so for decoy carving in marsh, one of the elements of the festival that we're working through is that decoys float on water, and they put out dozens of them in a rig. And when you put them in the water, they're supposed to turn upright. So that way, as they're being used as tools, they perform. And they also are quite beautiful when they're deployed on the water. So we're going to have demonstrations on the water as the Maryland Folklife area is positioned along the riverwalk of the Salisbury downtown. So we're going to be able to see these decoys used in working conditions. And Rich is very skilled at interpreting, and he actually will have his apprentice, Kenny Glasgow, with him, and he works multi-generationally with some of Kenny's grandchildren. So you'll be able to see the decoys being carved. You'll be able to see them being floated. And it will be a great opportunity.
So I also want to turn to something that's iconic, which, of course, is the skipjack. There used to be actually hundreds out in the bay. Now, of course, there are maybe a couple of dozen at the most now that have been preserved. And one of the leaders, by the way, in all of that has been Stoney Whitelock, who refurbished the Catherine, is now on to other vessels as well. He's a fourth-generation skipjack captain. And he's been involved, obviously, in the Deal Islands annual skipjack races and festival, which happens every year. I want to run a little clip of Stoney, and this is actually from an interview that we did with him some time back.
I've known all these captains and all these boats all my life. When we sat to the dinner table on Sundays, that's all the conversation was, skipjacks. I could name names that's gone in 50 years gone. Fast boats and good boats and carry a lot of oysters. And
how many skipjacks were out there when you were growing up?
I would say it was 30 or 40 right in this general area, in Winona and Deal Island and Chance, probably 30 or 40. And as they got old and deteriorated like that one over there, it was too expensive to rebuild them, so they just pulled them up on the mudflats when they were done with them.
So, Laura, there's a tradition that seems to be disappearing. He's trying to hold them up. Describe for our audience this the importance particularly of this vessel.
Well, it carries the growth of our region as the oysters were harvested and the communities that were built around the thriving seafood industries into the present day. We have working skipjack captains. We have working skipjacks, and it's a way that we can see that industry as still alive. I mean, how many people love to eat oysters?
Right.
But there's also the maintenance of the boats, but then the maintenance of the tradition. And so folks like Captain Stoney are, as tradition bearers, very much sharing this relationship that they've had, personal history, but then also their sort of broader community history through these vessels. Also featured at the Nationals on our will be Captain Kermit Travers, who is from Dorchester County. He's one of the only African-American skipjack captains. And so those two men have presented together at other events, and it's just this incredible dynamic to hear how the captains relate to one another and how there's a whole workforce and industry that is basically between these men, their boats, and the communities that they serve. And so we're hoping to be able to share some of that in the Maryland Folklife area at the Nationals. But then we also know that there are plans for some of our captains to actually bring their skipjacks and dock them right outside the Salisbury Marina for the event. So, because these are working boats, they exist. And why drive by car when you can...
Right. Go by boat.
Go by skipjack.
Right.
So the people who come to the National Folk Festival will be able to have that direct touch to the people, to the vessels. We also are partnering with the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum. They have an incredible restoration program. They do skipjack restoration there. They will be able to talk about some of that. But one of the major installations that we're going to be having on the grounds of the Nationals is the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum program is actually going to be building a Smith Island skiff from scratch. So over the course of the 3-day period, this skiff will be built by their master boat builders, and to be able to see that construction is really amazing. And so part of their skill set is not only a new construction of these traditional work boats, but maintenance and restoration of the historic vessels like the skipjacks.
Because obviously they're disappearing. I mean, as I mentioned a moment ago, do you think that this art form will ever disappear from the area, or do you think? I mean, Stoney's out there, trying to get them refurbished, but a lot of these boats, some of them are 100 years old. And the captains are getting pretty old too.
It's a great question. I would hope that the answer is no, it will not. maintenance preservation is effort. And so it's occasions like the work that we hold at the museum, at the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, and now with the National Folk Festival, where the communities will see the importance of these objects for carrying tradition and the people who work on them to be supported and recognized in their community as, it is civic engagement in order to hold on to history and to keep it part of the living fabric of our communities. That's part of what the festival tries to do, is to reflect on living traditions, things that are part of the culture of the community and our life ways. We didn't talk yet about the Pocomoke Indian Nation. Are going to be one of our featured presenters. And so, you talk about the breadth of time that's carried by the tribal members who will be exhibiting at the festival. Chief Norris Howard has been able to maintain through demonstrations and through community engagement traditions that go back thousands of years through his community, and we'll be sharing them alongside the work that we've already talked about. And there's rich connections there, and I think it's just a beautiful opportunity for people then to empower themselves to say, what can I do to make sure that this part of what is special to me and my community can be, answer your question, available for future generations.
Well, talking about somebody actually keeping the story alive, as it were, this is Janice Marshall. She's described as a storyteller, amongst other things, sixth generation Smith Islander, born Tylerton on Smith Island, married to a waterman, harvesting crabs and oysters and so on. Let's hear a little clip from her talking about a prayer, which then turns into a song for the watermen facing storm.
Anywhere it's watermen or fishermen, this is our prayer.
In the dark, of the midnight have I all hid my face, while the storms howl above me and there's no hiding place. Mid the crash of the thunder, precious Lord, hear my cry. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. Till the storm passes over. Till the thunder sounds no more. Till the clouds roll forever from the sky.
That we want to say that that's part of, I believe, the United Methodist Women who are singing that song. And the thing that really sort of struck me about it was that it really kind of captured that sort of certain loneliness, I guess, in terms of, you know, the women who are left behind as their husbands go out. And it's a very tough business. I mean, it's cold, and I've talked to a number of skipjack guys, a lot of people going out, and it's not an easy life. And then the dangers that they face.
And it's a life that affects the entire community and the entire household. So you have the women and the children who are being raised, and you think, you know, you've heard on the island that, you know, you have to come to school by boat, everything, and the distance, and just and how an island community has such a richness and a distinctness, and, you know, their souls are shaped and they express them by the richness and power of their relationship to their place and their circumstance. I'll ask Julia this question, if you don't mind, Julia, been interested in how spirituality is such a part of the underlying aspects of community traditions. And I know that you've dealt with these things at other events very successfully.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, there will be a number of artists not only associated with occupational culture in the Chesapeake, but also several performers who will be expressing some of the very powerful spiritual musics of the region.
One of turns, matter of fact, talking about music, there's the sensational Royal Lights. For over 60 years, they've traveled throughout Delmarva, deliver their music and their ministries through a quartet-style gospel music. Apparently originated in Cortown, which is a small community that's located near Cambridge. Let's hear the quartet first, and then we'll talk about it. And Julia, I understand this is not the first encounter you've had with this group. Tell us a little bit about it.
No, we have actually brought the Sensational Royal Lights to other events around the country. They performed recently at the press conference at the Ward, introducing the Folklife program, and they brought the house down. This is amazing tradition, and all of the members are family, and of course this is started over 60 years ago by the late Howard and Rena Elliott, brought their sons together to perform, and now of course we're into three generations at least of the Elliott family being a part of this group. this tradition, and you know, I have to tell you that these guys, you hear them here with the back line, drums and keys and so on. When they sing without any accompaniment at all, it's incredible. So this is a tradition of the Gospel Quartet, really was inspired by the gospel choirs like the Fisk Jubilee Singers back in the 1870s, who were performing spirituals as part of their program. They toured nationally and internationally, and they really helped to launch this gospel quartet tradition. So it's been a part of the fabric of American music for quite a long time.
Laura, what about this tradition on the shore? I mean, we've had an African-American community, both free and enslaved before the Civil War, and now we have, and that music really grows out of that.
Well, I think as it is, again, the community structures are around celebration, they're around endurance, and as we know through this gospel quartet, that it is a way to bring together people every day, every week, every year in a positive, spiritually enriching opportunity for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there are a lot more acts and a lot more events that are going to be going on in September. We've only scratched the surface here, but I do want to thank Julie Olin. She's Executive Director of the National Council for Traditional Arts. Also, locally, Laura Bottinelli. She's Executive Director of the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art. Appreciate you both coming in and chatting with us. No doubt we will chat again as we get closer to see what more acts you folks have cooked up for us.
Thank you.
This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hope you can join us this Saturday night from 8 to 10 for Vintage Country with me, Tom Pittman. At the top of the second hour, we're going to be featuring the top 10 for today's date in 1959. Theme time will include songs about the devil. The devil assumes lots of personas in country music. He's the guy that you blame things on that you don't want to take responsibility for yourself. And he also inhabits loved ones that are not behaving the way you think they ought to. Vintage Country here on WSDL.
I'm Eric Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit onto the daily news shows. This American Life.
Sunday at noon on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
Good morning. This is Delmarva Today. I'm Gretchen Hansen, sitting in with Don Rush. This morning, we will be examining the misinformation and confusion surrounding the immigration situation. My guest is attorney Alan Orr with Orr Immigration in Washington, D.C. Frankly, the bio Mr. Orr sent me this week was so long and so impressive, it would literally take the whole half hour to cover it. So I'm just going to say that he's been testifying on Capitol Hill this week regarding this issue, as well as appearing as an expert on most of the major news outlets in the world, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Fox News, BBC, Deutsche W, and now welcome to Delmarva Public Radio, Mr. Orr. I'm sure this won't be the media highlight of your week, but I thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to help us untangle the situation.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Alan, let's start with the policy. The Flores Settlement of 1997 mandated that unaccompanied children be placed in the least restrictive setting while awaiting an immigration hearing. What of the original intent of this settlement, and how has it informed the policy of removing children from their families under the new zero tolerance policy?
Right. So I think it's important to understand that the Flores Settlement is law, and executive order is drama, theater, something that was produced in order to sort of quell the masses and it really did nothing. So Flores is in place, and 20 days is the rule. And actually, the federal government went into court yesterday to say, could you reopen the Flores settlement to reevaluate the welfare of children? And I just feel the Flores settlement has been in place for 20 years, so it's highly unlikely that a judge today is going to say, oh, back then we made this decision, and today we're going to change our mind. Unlikely.
So are you saying that the administration is using the Flores settlement to politicize this detention for children?
So what the Flores settlement does, I mean, what the executive order, the goal of the executive order was to say, you know what, I'm not going to separate these families anymore. And so what he'll do now is put the families in a detention center together. So family jails is no better than individual jails on the long term, sort of as a policy issue. But once the day is reached, the 21st day is reached, and then the court order comes in and they have to remove the children, the Trump administration is going to be able to say, oh, it's not us. It's the judiciary that's requiring us to remove these children. So it's just sort of kicking the can someplace else, when in fact what needs to sort of be amended is the zero tolerance policy and with regards to how we're actually detaining these individuals.
So have children ever been removed from their parents in the past? Is it the implementation of the zero tolerance policy and the fact that they're just informing the use of the Flores agreement to settlement to allow that?
Right. So let's just sort of, you know, I think it's really important from the start to say that the Obama administration was not much better on the family detention area. And then some kids probably were removed. I can't say definitely that kids were not removed, but not at the rate they are right now. Right. So what has happened in this Trump administration and the zero tolerance sort of policy is that more kids are being removed as a deterrent for people sort of applying for lawful asylum. And so it's a new uptake because the president has already been in office for almost 2 years. Right. And if this were his policy from the very beginning, we would have had the same uproar. Right. The same level of injustice.
So that brings up another question. Could you explain the terminology of illegal alien, illegal border crossing, and asylum seeker, and why this is so important in the context? And then I want to address why this has changed with the zero tolerance policy.
Sure. So I think I can sum it up there are hundreds of lawful ways to enter the United States on different visas. And thousands of individuals, hundreds of thousands of individuals apply for entry to the United States every day at all ports of entry across the United States. So a couple of thousand or 2,000 or 20,000 or whatever you want to say it is at the southern border is not some alarmist situation because they're all trying to make a lawful entry through asylum. So no one is illegal until they've entered the United States and not applied for a visa. So in this situation, what we're sort of missing here is that we're deeming everybody to be illegal when, in fact, these people are applying for lawful entry. In this evaluation, what the Trump administration has done is changed law and policy. Generally, you can apply for asylum as long as you're in the United States, in the custody of the United States government, right?
Right.
What the zero tolerance memo says is, you can only apply for asylum if you come to a designated port of entry. And the problem at the designated port of entry today is that the current administration is turning people away. They're basically saying, today we're closed, could you come back tomorrow? Or we don't have enough staff for you today. Or saying, you know, we're not really interested in hearing your claim for asylum right now. It's just too many people. And what I think is super important in this space is, me as a lawyer to tell you, that due process and justice does not respond to numbers. Due process and justice applies to the individuals. So it doesn't matter if there's one or 10,000, they all should get the same due process and justice.
So you're saying that with these designated border crossings, which I assume have been limited in scope, people are having to travel miles and miles to get there, and then when they can't go through, they use another alternate to try and get into the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm not even sure if they use another alternate. I mean, I think we also need to think about who these individuals are.
Mm-hmm.
They're young mothers traveling hundreds or thousands of miles with their children. And if you've never been to the United States, the concept of knowing where the port of entry is, or maybe even reading a map, right, when you're not from Mexico or an adjoining country, is beyond me. So it may be the only place where they know to enter, right? So this level of education that we're assuming these individuals have, I think is also problematic, right? They're appearing at the U.S. border at the place where they arrived.
Let me ask you this, this is Don Rush. Step back just a moment. Are we seeing necessarily a surge in refugees and people coming particularly out of the Honduras, El Salvador area, because I know that there's been an increasing amount of drought in a couple of the countries. We've seen violence and so on. Give us a sense about who these people are as they come up.
Right. So you're exactly right. It is no longer Mexican nationals that are sort of applying for asylum at the border right now. It's mostly people who are coming up from third countries that border Mexico that have to travel through Mexico to get to our ports of entry. So that is a correct assumption. The overall analysis is that immigration is at a low, right? Immigration, the sort of influx of immigrants coming to the country is at a low. And sort of when you look at the statistics that the government is giving you, understand they don't give you raw numbers. What they give you are percentages. They say it's up 300%. It's up 400%, right? The number of families traveling is, you know, up 200 and something odd percent. But without the underlying numbers, you're not able to really evaluate that percentage because was there one and now there's four? Or was there, you know, thousands and now there are hundreds of thousands? So it's really just, and to be honest with you, the situation at the border is just for political background noise from pushing towards the midterm because there really should be no crisis. We're the United States of America. We're able to sort of process these individuals in a lawful way and make the appropriate assessment as to whether they qualify for asylum or they don't.
Can you tell me a little bit about their journey? I mean, this is an arduous journey that they take. They know it's going to be an arduous journey. It's not something that people decide lightly.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not something that people would take lightly, and it's also something that a mother with a small child would not do if they didn't have to, right? And so this evaluation of now we want to have a merit-based system, right? Who deserves more merit than a mother who decided that this situation was horrible for their children and they battled hundreds or thousands of miles to get to a place where there's safety for their children? If we were watching a movie, all of these individuals would be the individuals that we're cheering for. But in reality, now we're saying, oh, it's too many.
So what do you have to do to prove asylum or that you qualify for asylum? And how is the administration trying to change that? You're talking about young mothers. What would they say when they got to the border in order to be granted asylum?
So here's where a lot of the confusion sort of takes place. And there's the conversation about this invasion of individuals. So a couple of weeks ago, maybe three, the Attorney General certified a case to himself from his branch regarding asylum. It's called Matter of AB. And in his decision, he decided that no longer would individuals who were coming to the United States qualify for asylum if they were running away from gang violence or domestic violence, right? Because those are private actors and not from a governmental organization. So that really changes the landscape of what it is to have a credible fear for a lot of these individuals, right? Because the confusion between a gang and the government in most of these countries is difficult, right?
Right.
So having that concept in your mind, someone who has traveled 100 miles or 1,000 miles, either on a train or by foot, who appears at a border office, let's say they're at a port of entry, and then having to make a claim, probably wouldn't have what's on their person, if they left at the last moment, the documents to prove that, right? Or even the wherewithal to sort of assess that case. So what the government would like to do is to sit down with them in a 5 or 30 minute sort of interview and make an assessment of them, right? That's not justice and that's not due process, right? And so the level that they're sort of sending, it's high. But what Jeff Sessions was not able to do is with the 600,000 cases that's a backlog in the United States right now, is to sort of say, for all of these cases that are just based on, you know, gang violence or domestic violence, I'm going to throw those cases out. Because, as I said before, in our court system, each case is an individual assessment of that individual person's crisis or problem.
So with the due process question, you said there's over 600,000 cases. How are we going to work through that backlog as well as return these children to their parents for these 2,300 children that have now been removed from their parents? How long will that process take?
Okay. So on the backlog, we'll go back there in a second. Because these individuals now who are separated from the parents aren't in that backlog, right? Because part of what we're now doing is we're taking a civil matter and running it through the criminal court, so therefore we're backlogging our courts at the border with these criminal cases, right, that we never would do before. And before having an assessment as to whether the person has a legal asylum claim, which is a legal entry, they take their child, right, and if the mother may be detained in Texas, the child could be in New York by now, or Florida, right, without a real assessment of how they're linked together. In the news feed yesterday, when the president's wife visited the center said, boasted proudly, that it's generally around 42 days to reunite, the families after the parent is released. I don't know in what situation a parent will find that comforting to say to them, your child has been missing, or we took your child, not missing, we took your child from you. We'll gladly return them to you in 42 days.
What did you,
on
by the,
average.
By the way, what did you make of the First Lady's visit?
It was, I think she does have a heart. I think she is a mother, but I think it was also part of theater. It didn't really change anything, and unfortunately, because of the weather, she didn't actually get to go to the holding facility, right? That's where the kids are in cells or the sheets. She went to a detention center that's after the fact, right? And her assessment of what's going on with those kids, not being a doctor or a psychiatrist or anyone in the healthcare field, you know, just being a mom, seeing they looked happy and they were playing, I don't know if that's a valid assessment for me to sort of live with.
Did you say
and the main concern for media at this point is, why can't we see, right? Why is there this barrier from the media for actually seeing the whole process as it happens? That's the major issue, and that's the real thing that says something's not right, right?
Were you disappointed about the fact that it didn't, at least from what I saw, that she didn't appear, at least on camera, meet with any of the children? We're reminded, by the way, earlier that during the AIDS crisis, the First Lady under H.W. Bush actually went to an AIDS place where there were children and held them and so on, and there could be seen with the First Lady doing that. Were you disappointed that it didn't seem to be interaction? Certainly, at least we didn't see it.
I'm disappointed she didn't go see the mothers. She's a mother. That's her closest link to these individuals who are trying to do the best for their children, right? We also remember that she remained in New York for months after the president was in the White House because she didn't want to disarm her child from his schooling. So why is she not concerned about all these parents who are now trying to do the best they can for their kids, seeking refuge for them in a country that offers it, and now they're separated from their kids? So why not go visit them? They're not criminals. Right, doing the best for your kid and your family is not a criminal assessment. No one would think that.
So ABC News estimated this morning that over 2,300 children have been separated from their parents since May. Is there any plan for reuniting these children? We talked about the backlog of cases. We talked about it taking 42 days. But what is the plan? Because most of these kids, some of them are tender age and babies. How would they even know if the records weren't being kept where these children are?
Right. And so I think, you know, you've seen sort of the political backlash of saying, you know, anywhere you go in the United States with your luggage or anything else, they'll tag it so that they can return it to you. Well, kids aren't done that way, right? They weren't really sure of the familial relationship in the first place. And if you're 5 months old, you're not going to be able to say, oh, that's my mother, right? And that's really the big liability that the federal government has taken on by separating these kids and families. The other issue is they're not reuniting them in the United States, right? They're reuniting them outside of the United States, which is even more problematic because it exposes the kids to additional danger by returning them to some second country in some cases or their home country without their parents being there. Imagine your 10-year-old just dropped off on the street not knowing if the parents are there or not, because it's not like there's this network where we're going to call them on their cell phone or send them an email and tell them what time they're going to arrive.
So that brings up a question that I received a lot on social media, a lot of backlash. And some people are saying that these children are actually victims of human trafficking, and that's why they're being detained. In your experience, has there been any incidents of this at all? And if there is, what percentage?
It's a small percentage, right? It's actually looking for the answer that you wish to receive. You can believe anything you want to believe about them being victims. But in most cases, yeah, they're victims of the societies that they were in, and that's why their parents fled for them, right? There's no huge sort of migrant problem of grabbing kids and running to the border from the cartels, because most of the cartels, if they're going to enter, they're going to enter on planes, right? That is not how that sort of issue of detaining women and children at the border does not break our drug problem in the United States at all. And in the drug issue, MS-13, started in California, right? So that's not something unique to the United States. So we shouldn't blame people who are looking for a valid reason to enter the United States for other issues that we have. That's scapegoating, right? That's the political nature of all of this.
Do you feel that this policy is racialized in some way, to try and keep people of color out of the country as well as keeping Muslims out of the country? Our immigration policy seems to be focused on a lot of different countries that Trump has identified repeatedly. And this seems to be directed specifically at Central and South America.
If you look at everything that's happened in this administration without isolation, the ending of TPS, the talking about the DACA classifications, how we sort of protect our borders and who we keep out of the country, there's a very focused color line among those sort of enforcement policies without even saying it, right? It's just a reality that sort of exists there. In the same way, there's also an economic social class argument to be had about keeping these immigrants out of the United States, right? Because if I were wealthy, I could take a plane, land in New York City, and say, I want asylum, right?
Right.
With all of my kids, who may or may not be my kids. And at that point, I would not be detained, right? I would not, I'd have the same sort of hearing that would happen at the border, but I wouldn't be treated the same way, right? No one's going to come to New York and say, oh, we're closed today for New York, right? So those are some of the social economic changes that sort of stress the system. But I think what's most important to also understand is that the concept is when you stress the system enough, if we can talk about Maryland and California and sort of the farmers right now, the government will respond. And part of that response is in the nature to Trump's own businesses, Mar-a-Lago, right? And the H-2B visas, right? And then there just weren't enough farm workers coming to any of these places right now to make sure that they have a productive season, right? Since 2013, I think farmers have decreased in profits by 50% in the United States. So not allowing this foreign labor to come in and do these jobs that Americans aren't doing for whatever reason, then we're sort of hurting ourselves, right? I think in 2017, they sort of looked at Mar-a-Lago when the election first started, and there were some 400 workers that were hired for a season. And out of those 400 workers, one of them was a United States citizen. All the others were on these seasonal visas where they come in and they do a work exchange. So there's a little bit of a dynamic of saying, we don't need workers, unemployment's low, we want it orderly, but we don't want it orderly from the Mexico port of entry because they could basically allow these individuals to come in, handle the asylum claim, and either return them to their country if the asylum claim is not valid, or allow them in to complete the processing.
How much do you think is this attached to the idea that they want to reduce immigration overall?
I think it is attached. It's attached to the concept that immigrants are bad. But for me, as an African-American lawyer, I think it's also attached to the concept of colorism in the United States that we're browning a little bit fast, right? Because there are other dynamics also at play in immigration in the employment arena. There are tons of Chinese nationals and Indian nationals who have been here for decades working under the H-1B visa, moved into the green card analysis, and now they're told you need to wait some 10 to 20 years to be able to apply for your green card just because we want to control the numbers.
So
right? Not about them voting. I mean, it's all about them voting. It's not about them paying taxes. They have houses here. Some of them have kids here, right? There's no other reason to wait than to just wait because they're not waiting outside the country. They're already here. So that sort of is a problem, right, when you sort of look at who is waiting and who is not waiting.
So they've dropped the immigration levels or what they want the immigration levels to be to less than 1930 standards. Do you feel that those are unfairly biased towards countries like Norway that are desirable immigrants and not towards countries maybe like Honduras where the immigrant may come with less of an education?
Yeah, I think it's hard to make those assessment evaluations between someone's value at the time you see them, right? Because these kids, all of them could be scholars.
Exactly.
Later in life. All of them, maybe one of them has the solution for cancer, right? Just because someone has reached a high level at a deeper age doesn't mean that these other individuals don't have the same potential evaluation within them. And as we just discussed about the quotas for each country, controlling where individuals come from, if you reduce the numbers, then you will have a backlog for all these countries where a lot of people come from and a non-backlog in these other countries. So that's systematically one of the things that's at stake here. You know, what's important about this Ryan bill that's being debated right now in Congress is it goes to eliminate two family categories and a diversity visa. 69% of Africans come to this country through those categories, right?
Can you explain the two family categories and the diversity for our listeners that don't know that?
Yeah, so there is a preference system for family categories in which we allow people to sponsor their kids or their aunts and uncles or their brothers and sisters. Of course, the immediate ones are your wife and your kids, right? So some of the eliminations in this new bill is to eliminate some of those tangential, or what they call tangential family relationships, which I say are just family relationships, your brothers and sisters, right, and your unmarried adult kids, right? They want to eliminate those from the family categories. The diversity visa is something that the United States thought was a good concept, in which sort of balanced immigration around the world, in which if you had a certain level of education, you put yourself in a pool of selected people, and then just like with a lottery, certain people would win and certain people would not win, right? And then you would have a year to sort of complete that process. And so now the government has basically said, "Is we don't want to do that anymore. It's too random. We don't know who we're getting, you know, what have you, right?" And that's just not the appropriate way, because for a lot of Africans, as I've stated before, that's how they enter the country. That's how they become doctors. That's how they, you know, have the option to sort of come here, because no other visa category is specific to them.
Right? Now, let me ask you this. How does this, do you think, compare to, say, the 1920s, in which they cut back on immigration, particularly as they were concerned about Eastern Europeans and Italians, for example, altering the demographics? I mean, are we experiencing something similar, do you think?
I think we were experiencing something worse.
Okay, go ahead.
In that we don't have the reality that in order for us to survive, we actually need this immigration, right? And so those groups, the concern before in the 20s was that we don't know them, right? They're other, right? At this point, within the United States, there are a lot of different communities that we have a representation that we can experience people from these different countries. It's not as if there's never been people from, you know, Honduras. So there are hundreds of thousands of them on the TPS program, right? So it's a little bit more of a concern, a little bit more direct of a concern of saying we don't want people here anymore for political reasons, right? Because it makes people believe that there's a fear and a threat of someone taking something from them, right? Eat their job or a chance for an education or some of those other things. But with unemployment being the all-time low that it is, right, it's sort of problematic. And I sort of think when you think about this in a broader scheme of what's happening with U.S. policy, how we're sort of moving away from all of these human rights pacts that we've had before and commissions, it becomes problematic with who we say we are as by the Constitution.
So I don't have the statistics in front of me, but in part of the research I did, I read that immigrants actually put more into the system than they take out, because most of them contribute to Social Security, and yet they don't get Social Security as they get older, and we're talking about undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've experienced in your own work, and can you comment a little bit more on why the farmers' profits are down so much? I had so much trouble getting a farmer to admit that on the radio. Nobody was willing to come on the radio and talk about the fact that they do hire immigrants.
Well, I think, on the farmer immigrant part, and then you have to ask at the beginning of the question again, sure, because I think that's super important, is that there are visas that you can apply for that are seasonal visas, right? The problem with applying for the seasonal visas are the administrative backlog, right? So you have to assume when your bill and your patch is going to be ready to make sure that the workers are here either a little bit before and long enough to last the season. And that's sort of what's happening in Maryland, right? And so at that concept, when you're a business owner, right, you make a business decision about keeping your business open. And if you need workers, right, then you evaluate that against, you know, how many I-9s I'm going to do, right? Nobody wants to get on the radio and sort of make a claim that they have undocumented workers, because the government's also ramping up on that, right? The government just got 149 people or picked up 149 people that they suspect of being undocumented workers in Ohio, right, to add to the system. So that's that problem. And the problem that farmers have is that is even if they pay the higher wages, right, we're talking $13 to do whatever, pick apples, pick cherries, do crabbing, right, they're still not getting U.S. workers to come do those jobs, right, because we've told our U.S. workers they're too good for those jobs, basically, right? And so that's problematic in our society. And that sort of leads them to then make decisions where stuff's going to rot in the field if they can't get the workers in time, right? And then we're going to lose the farm, and then we become more of an import for our farming and whatnot. And you see that a lot in California, where they're sort of talking about stuff rotting on the vine. So then the government said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to give 15,000 more of these visas in a lottery system, right? And that's also problematic, because then you don't know if you're going to get them or not, right? You have to go through the lottery system, and then you have to get them here. So that's sort of the issue. On the other front, if you removed all of the undocumented taxes, right, that are paid, and I think this is super important, because people think, oh, they don't pay income taxes. Well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't know. Some people may be doing 1099s, and some people may not be doing 1099s. But they're still paying all the local taxes, right? They're still buying all the homes in those communities. They're buying the gas in those communities, right? So they are supporting those communities. In a lot of cases, that people who are working under someone else's Social Security number, they're paying into a system they'll never get that money back for, right, at all, right? So sort of removing all of that, removing that class of people from our Social Security network is going to bankrupt the system, because we already know that, you know, basically the workers today are paying for the workers who have retired. And sort of removing TPS, the DACA people that we added, and others, is removing billions of dollars in taxes from all of these communities, which just doesn't make sense at all.
So can I ask you about a comment by Jeff Sessions? He was talking about whether the policy is a deterrent, and he said, hopefully people will get the message and come through the border at the port of entry and not break across the border unlawfully. Is this basically saying that if you come across the border unlawfully, we're going to take your children? What was the justification for that statement?
That's exactly what it is, which also needs to be sort of taken to federal court and threatened, because that's not what the law says. The law says as long as you're in the United States and you're captured. So, and also there should be some analysis with regards to what the port of entry is. But I think there's a little bit of a, I don't know. Are these countries where there's all this gang violence, are there individuals sitting at home listening to CNN in their language, interpreting and evaluating what he's saying to do the cost-benefit analysis of making that trip? Most likely not, right? Former Homeland Security Director Jed Johnson said, the issue isn't really about how we solve exactly the runs currently at the border, but what are the situations in those home countries? How can we make it better for them there, right? Because most would choose not to leave if they could remain in their situation, because most have said, you know, I've been there for so long until they said they were going to kill me, or I've been paying this extra gang tax for so long, should be more the focus, right? So this, so that little bit of saying, I dare you to come, I'm going to take your children, is, could be scary to individuals, but in some cases, if you're a mother and you think that someone's going to come shoot your child tomorrow, it's a hard choice to make, but I think you would make the choice to try to make the travel and maybe have your kids separated and live apart from you. And that's a very difficult situation, and something this country has dealt with before with African Americans, right?
So
the same sort of situations in our own cities, in inner city violence, of sort of removing kids from family and making assessments about what's best for them and sort of ignoring the need of the child, right? And parents deciding, you know, it's better for me to go away, let the kid be a ward of the state in order for the kid to eat and survive. Those are difficult parent decisions.
So what you're saying basically is what's happened at the border is a human rights violation. It's not merely a legal problem. It's
The separation of the kids is a due process problem on every level, right? I mean, we just saw there was a settlement in the first case that was filed in California, I think yesterday, with regards to one parent who was separated from her child, and they were reunited yesterday. But the concept of taking a child from a parent is abhorrent to everything our culture and society stands for. So human rights violation, yes. Due process violation, yes. Constitutional violation, yes. Moral problem, absolutely.
What is your solution? What would you do?
Yeah, I think so. There are less evasive ways for us to sort of control the influx of migrants to the United States like we do at other ports of entry, right? So I think one of the things that we stop doing is saying that it's a crisis, and we look at it like we look at every other port of entry. That's number one. Number two, we give people due process through the system to make their ripe claims and send them back, right? Family jails, there are less evasive ways to sort of make sure individuals appear at their court dates while they're in the United States. You know, ankle bracelets in some case, you know, a monitor in some case. There's tons of other things that you can do, right? But the concept of sort of separating children from their family or taking a whole family and putting them in jail indefinitely is problematic, right? That's just super problematic. So in addition to those things, a little bit of what the former secretary said was that we should look to sort of making sure their country conditions are better, because that'll solve the problem long term. If that's really what we're talking about, this constant flux of individuals from these crime states that are at our border, in our atmosphere, then why are we not, you know, we can go halfway around the world for other people, but why are we not concerned about these individuals, right? Because we should see that as a human rights issue for that country, and we get involved in other things, right? If we have time to sort of go to space to sort of protect the world or protect our country, I don't understand why we don't have time to sort of make sure that our continent is okay.
So, Alan Orr, I want to thank you for your time today. This has been unbelievably informative. You can follow Alan Orr on Twitter at Alan Orr, E-S-Q. I'm Chef Gretchen Hansen. You can follow me at chefgretchenhansen.com. And I want to thank my guest host, Don Rush. Thank you for a lovely morning on Delmarva today.